Accession number 13271, reel 8.
Was it important for you to have the support of groups, you know, once you had reached this sort of change of mind?
Oh, yes. I said to Exosis E&D when the dust had settled that if they hadn't existed, I would have had to have invented them. But I didn't join C&D mainstream. I felt they were too discredited. They also, of course, had been pilloried when I was still in the Navy as being a traitorous group, you know. And I remember the experience of sharing a platform for the first time with Bruce Kent and feeling very traumatized by that, because I had been told that Bruce Kent was a chap that a military man should not be seen in public with, you see. That was the sort of attitude that was coming through. And I really had fallen for that. So I joined Exosis C&D quite specifically because they were a separate organization from C&D, and they were all veterans who had thought this thing through in the same way as I had. And they're very small, but they were undoubtedly the right people for me. And I did feel very much that I needed, you know, their support and approval, because they must have been quite suspicious of me and wondered whether I was, you know, for real. I was fortunate because I found that there were two other officers of my generation who were already, they were both RAF actually, one of them now, John Morrison, is chair of Ex-Services C&D, and Murray Franklin was the other, and he had been a navigator in Canberras with nuclear weapons in East Germany, in Germany. So, yes, I did need their support. But I also felt that I needed to keep my distance from the pacifist area, and that was the other problem about C&D. I felt that C&D had been hijacked by the pacifists. They'd certainly been portrayed as not just anti-nuclear, but anti-war. And that was too much for me. And to a certain extent, I still think that's justified. So that's why I moved more enthusiastically towards just defense, which did not have that position, and which was thinking through the whole business of military strategy in much more depth and was more coherent. And I felt that there was a job for me to do there in terms of providing a bridge, if I could, between the military and the pacifists, if you like. But specifically, my top priority was to provide a golden bridge for the politicians and the military to retreat over from nuclearism. And that was where I felt I had a role to play.
Did you ever meet Vic Williams during the Gulf Crisis?
Yes, I did. I first met him when I shared a platform with him, in fact, in one of the demonstrations in Hyde Park. And I think that was the first time he had spoken in public since going absent without leave from his unit in Germany.
Yes, what did you think of his situation? You know, bearing in mind that he was a volunteer soldier.
Well, this, of course, was a totally new problem for me. It forced me to confront not just conscientious objection, but selective conscientious objection by a volunteer. I think that's almost unique. And I wrote an article which John Wilkins, the editor of the Tablet, very generously published in September in 1991. It was just after Vic's court-martial. And I put down my thoughts in that. And I talked to Vic several times before and after that court-martial. And, of course, I appeared in the BBC programme Heart of the Matter, devoted to him. And I felt that he was a man of great integrity. He was loyal to the army, but he felt betrayed by it. But maybe not so much by the army, but by the politicians who had made the army do what they did in the Gulf. And I think he felt that he was not alone either. He's told me that there was quite substantial support, even among the junior officers in his regiment, but they couldn't speak out. And incidentally, he felt it vital that he did not just refuse to go, because he would never be heard of again. He had to go absent without leave in order to be able to explain it publicly. And he did just that. And then he gave himself up once he knew that the explanation was going to be broadcast. But it seems that the armed forces just can't handle this one at all. And they still talk about lack of moral fibre from the First World War, when in fact I think what the problem is too much moral fibre. And I think there's a terrible dishonesty going on, and a refusal to tackle a subject that requires great sensitivity and great awareness and great compassion. And I think they've got to watch it, the armed forces, about this one, because they are requiring more intelligent and better educated servicemen to man these highly sophisticated weapon systems these days, and therefore you're going to get the sort of guy like Vic coming up more often. And on top of that, you are now requiring them mainly to operate under United Nations auspices. NATO is becoming a lower priority. The United Nations has a completely different job to do, in my opinion, and as such they have got to redefine the reasons that people are joining. Because one of Vic's big complaints was that the UN's principles had been perjured in shifting the policy from military containment, of which he was proud to be going out as part of, to a punitive expedition under United States control. And not only that, but the public were being hoodwinked about it. And the army was silent about it. They didn't complain. And on top of that, he was being brainwashed into hating Iraqis suddenly, and this was a racist thing. And generally, the whole ethos of the British Army as being, you know, a professional armed force that was there impartially as a sort of chivalrous knight role was being abused. And it's not what he joined for. And he'd had 5 happy years in the army. He was quite happy about fighting IRA terrorism and the whole business of NATO, but not this. And I think that the government ought to have thought this one through, and they haven't. I think they can watch out for more trouble if they try this again. And I believe that the high incidence of post-traumatic stress among the, particularly the infantry, who came face to face with these boys and old men in trenches in the Gulf when they were told to expect this super army and they had to burn at them. That is the consequence of that sort of operation. And you need mercenaries for that. You don't want professional volunteer soldiers like the army has professed to have. You're talking about killers for hire in that sort of operation. And I just feel that that was what Vic was protesting about, and I think he was right, but of course he was going to be a lone voice. And I was very depressed to see the way no one came out in support of him, really, from the armed forces. I suppose they couldn't move on it, but I have heard since that there was widespread support for him. I mean, he tells me about how NCOs would pass him in Woolwich Barracks and just quietly touch him on the shoulder and said, did the right thing. And so I just feel that he was vindicated, and I know his conscience is clear. And I believe the bottom line for him was that he couldn't trust himself to fight with full commitment, and therefore he might let down his friends, his colleagues, his mates. And, of course, people would say, well, he would say that, wouldn't he? But, no, Vic had too much for moral fibre.
How about your mates? Do you hear from any of your naval colleagues?
No, not really. I mean, there are just one or two close friends who I stay in touch with very quietly. But it is an area, I think, where I'm very concerned that I should not in any way jeopardise their position. And I have also come across a few who are obviously firmly supportive of nuclear deterrence and everything still. So I think there is, of course, the fact that I have had a unique experience. And I am becoming more and more aware of this. I have been through a steady progression of events, both within the Navy and then afterwards, which have radicalised me, and I've been in the position to act. I think that's the combination, which is unique. And so I'm not really expecting anybody else to come with me. I think that is the nature of the British system.
Well, Bob, thank you very much for telling me about your unique experience and for, you know, about your activity as well. And I hope you'll have me back again, perhaps in a year's time, to catch up. Thank
Lovely.
You very much.
Well, thank you.